Hello, welcome to the Roundhouse Podcast with Paul Solentrop of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. Thanks very much for listening. We appreciate your time. Wichita State tennis coaches Colin Foster and Dara Glavin are with us to recap 2024-2025. Both programs continue to improve and move back towards some of their historical levels of success, and we're going to talk to them about the past season. Colin Foster just completed his 16th season coaching the women's team, so we figured out he is the longest tenured tennis coach in Wichita State history. Dara completed his third season with the men's team. Men's team finished the spring 12-13, its most wins since 2022, and its best win percentage since 2021. They also recorded their first win in the AAC Championship since 2021. In March, they moved into the ITA's computer ranking at number 75. That was the program's first appearance in the ranking since 2023. Women's team went 13-10. They had wins over five teams, which are either ranked now or were ranked at the time when they played, including Kansas State and Kentucky. WSU ended the season number 63 in the ITA's computer rankings. They peaked at number 47 earlier in the season. That was their highest ranking since 2019. Multiple Shockers made the All-Conference women's team for the first time since 2018. Colin, let's start with the women. Run through the highlights of the season for us.
Yeah, thanks, and thanks for having us, Paul. So, yeah, you know, you touched on some of the team's success. Had a really difficult schedule, gave us opportunities in the national rankings. Took advantage of several of those, wins over Kentucky. Home win over Kentucky was honestly one of the highlights on the schedule. It was a Friday evening match. Huge crowd, really fun atmosphere for the players and for the fans. Individually, Sintong Wong, in the fall, it was new this season where they moved the individuals, so singles and doubles portion of the NCAA championships to the fall. And she qualified for the singles championship, ended up suffering an injury in that singles match. Wasn't anything major, but had to retire from her first round match. But she advanced to the finals of the Central Region Championships, which qualified her for the NCAAs, which was a really good accomplishment for her. Sintong and Georgia Roselli, who were our top two singles players and our number one doubles teams, as you mentioned, all conference. You know, they really held down the top two spots really well throughout the year. And really, we got contributions up and down the lineup. We were more or less the same team coming back as last year. We lost our numbers two and six player and kind of added two players who didn't play two and six. They played more like four, and then not in the lineup were the two newcomers. So on paper, maybe we would have taken a step back, but honestly, everyone grew. The team got closer, and that led to some of the team success that we have, as well as individual success.
Dara, take us through the men's season and how it unfolded.
Yeah, so for us, we had five new guys on the team this year, and then we also had our number one player that was injured last year, Christoph, return, so that was nice to have him back, and I think it just brought some depth to our team this year, so that really helped for us early on in the spring season, just having a full lineup and more depth, and it showed early on. You know, we had guys were able to compete with each other just for that bottom of the lineup, and just kind of push each other, which helped kind of keep everyone on their toes and keep them working hard. And I think, you know, we had a run early on of 4-3 losses that were tough, but it definitely helped us in the long run, and we got some wins after that. Against Denver was a big win for us after a couple of 4-3 losses, and that kind of helped turn around the season and then get a couple of wins in a row there. So that was really exciting, and just kind of, you know, we're able to see the hard work paying off and the guys able to persevere through some tough losses and just keep showing up and working and trying to just keep getting better, instead of, you know, sometimes you take those couple of close losses, you can kind of go the other way, but they kept showing up and were able to turn it around and, you know, get some good results throughout the rest of the season. And like you talked about, heading to conference with, you know, a little bit of confidence and get that first round win was great for us. You know, we've been close in the two seasons before. We're close in Orlando 2 years ago to getting a win there. And I think it was exciting for the guys just to kind of get that belief and, you know, trust that we can get those wins. Our conference, all the matches are 4-2, 4-3s. So it's always a good opportunity when you go into conference championship to get some wins. But yeah, definitely a good season to build on, and we're looking forward to the future.
Shockers defeated UAB in the first round of that that tournament that Dara mentioned. So another good place to get to early and kind of lay the groundwork for these two programs is talking about the American Athletic Conference. Very strong tennis conference. Four teams from the women's side are in NCAA play. Five are ranked in the top 55 of the ITA. Two from the men's side are in the NCAA field. Five teams are ranked in the top 75. Colin, I'll start with you. Why is the American such a good tennis conference?
Yeah, really, it's the depth, and, you know, we don't have a super strong, I think the highest ranked team was this year was Florida Atlantic, which was kind of in the 25 to 35 range most of the year. So it's that belief that everyone can beat anyone, you know, you're not running into. In the past, we had UCF was kind of a perennial top 10 or 15 team, so they were, you know, kind of separated themselves. SMU was starting to do that as well, but now it just feels wide open. A lot of good programs, obviously a lot of good coaches, good facilities, and programs that are investing in all their sports, as we're doing here at Wichita State. So, yeah, kind of run down some of those programs. Florida Atlantic was the one seed. So in the AAC, we don't play a full regular season round robin. We can schedule however we want throughout the season. You go to the conference tournament, and it's the seeding is done strictly off of the rankings. So we didn't get a chance to see FAU this year. But we lost 4-3 to Memphis, who ended up winning the conference championship out of the sixth seed. They played a really hard schedule, weren't ranked as high, but were battle-tested and ended up making a run at home at the AAC tourney and won it. We beat Tulsa in the regular season. Tulsa made a run to the finals, beating us along the way 4-3. And then they made a run to the finals, which got them an at-large spot in the NCAA tournament. And then we lost close. Well, actually, Rice was probably maybe one of our toughest matches of the year. We came up short against them. They're also an at-large team. And then we lost 4-3 to Charlotte. We actually added that match last minute. Us and Charlotte were kind of both looking like we were just outside the bubble for an at-large spot. So we made the decision to meet in Memphis a few days early, knowing that it would boost the ranking for one of us to take that shot, since we were both kind of on the outside looking in. Lost that match 4-3. Charlotte ended up being the three seed at AAC and lost to Memphis in the quarterfinals. So there you go. You got six teams in there that are all, you know, competing right there with each other. And the drop-off from 7 down to 13 is really not that steep, to be honest. I mean, Tulane is good. South Florida is good. UAB, UTSA. So depth.
Yep. Dara, describe the men's side of American Athletic Conference tennis.
I would say the same. The depth there is definitely there. I think when we played UAB the first time in season, it was a 4-2 close match battle right to the end. Like, could have gone either way. And then we got to play them in conference again and won 4-1. But again, it was close on other courts. And then same thing with South Florida. They were the one seed. We played them earlier in the season. Had a lot of opportunities, match points and doubles, a lot of set points to keep the match alive and whatnot. It was 6-1 overall, but again, a lot of courts, about five of the courts and singles that we had chances or set points to take sets that we just couldn't convert on. But again, every match you play in our conference, we feel the same, that anyone can beat anyone. Like South Florida this year, we're 25 highest ranked team, but again, the difference isn't too much, and it's definitely a winnable match. So I think the guys started to believe that in every match we played. You could definitely feel that, you know, we have a chance. Especially if you get the doubles point, doubles is key, you know, in these matches when, you know, it's going to be a close one in singles, because they're also talented, the depth and all the teams is right there. So, yeah, a lot of good opportunities. We try to schedule five or six. Like Colin said, there's no conference schedule, but we try to get five or six conference teams a year to just kind of see what we're going to be playing around tournament time, and just to be tested against these teams so we can be ready to go against them at championship time.
Does some of the strength of the American, does it come from weather? Does it come from private schools sometimes, excel in these kind of sports? Is there kind of a root cause of why the American is as good as it is?
Yeah, I think some of them have good locations. Like, you have Florida schools, but you do have the private schools with academics, and like Memphis with the big city. So I think it's very spread out. There's, good things about all the schools that just kind of, they have, you know, they're also putting resources into tennis and they're all wanting to do well. So I think, it's definitely one of the top conferences that we have for tennis. And we're right there, which is exciting for our guys to see. And I think, all from the men's side, 11 schools are investing and getting better each year. So it's definitely a mixture of everything from good weather to good coaches to just good academics and good cities. There's a lot of positives about all the schools in the conference.
I think if you're recruiting an American kid, they would know what the Big Ten is and be very locked into the SEC or whatever. Is it similar when you're recruiting a European athlete or a South American athlete?
You have to kind of explain to them a little bit more what the like Power Four conferences are and how close we are to those schools nowadays, especially for tennis. So it's just, you know, being able to sell our schedule, our strength of schedule and our conference, and just, you know, everyone, kids' dream is, you know, to give themselves the best chance to be a professional after college. And the way to do that and improve and develop is to play good competition. So for to be able to tell them about how good our conference is and the schedule we play, I think that helps us. I think for all the schools in our conference, we can prove just looking at, you know, the teams that we have in the conference and the competition we're going to play on schedule that you're going to improve and have some good competition every week.
So, Colin, Wichita State would have dominated the Missouri Valley Conference on the women's side before it moved to the American. Really one of the top two or three teams usually on the men's side, too. But women's, it was just, you know, really, really dominant. What's been the adjustment like? How has the program changed since joining the American now? I guess, what were it, 7 years? 2017-18, I guess, was the first year in the American.
Yeah, it is just that competitive depth that the league has that we didn't see in the Missouri Valley. You know, when we were in, and, you know, the scheduling piece that we both talked about that any coach in any sport will tell you is so important. You know, Missouri Valley, we pretty much knew we were going to win the conference and get that automatic bid for NCAA, so we could just schedule really as tough as we wanted in the non-conference, knowing that, hey, we're going to take our shots, you know, develop, you know, give ourselves chances in the rankings, maybe to get a better seed at NCAAs. And if things don't go great, well, we can fall back on winning the conference. Here in the AAC, with us, you know, one, it being way more competitive, you know, we're trying to create that right schedule where we're developing, you know, not getting beat up too much from a win-loss perspective. You don't want to schedule too hard. We're confidence-wise, you're getting, you know, dinged, but also you've got to have those opportunities in the rankings, especially when you've got a good team like we had this year, to give yourself those chances. And I think, you know, your question earlier about, you know, about the AAC and kind of some other reasons why it's so strong. Part of it is that we don't play the regular season schedule, and we really can put together, and it's a lot more work, obviously, to put that entire puzzle together of the entire season. And we do play other teams in the conference, because especially you get toward the later part of the season, a lot of other conferences are playing their regular season schedules. But, you know, budget-wise, competitive-wise, scheduling-wise, we can craft that schedule exactly the way that we see best. It doesn't always come out perfect, but, you know, to give our, you know, to peak at the right time, to have the right opportunities, make sure we've got, okay, maybe I need an easier match kind of this week because I got, you know, a tough road trip on either end of it. Things that you can't do when you have a conference mandated regular season. So it's a fun part of it to put that schedule together. It is tricky, and it is a big puzzle when you got to do the whole thing, but it can give you the right runway to have the kind of season that you anticipate having.
Dara, third year as a head coach, take us through what you've learned. What have you changed? What's this 3 year period been like for you as a coach?
Yeah, a lot of learning, a lot of mistakes, a lot of things to improve on. I think just for me, the big thing is, you know, managing people, and I think that's been the big learning curve for me, and just how to get the best out of everyone, the best out of, you know, my staff, people around, our resources, and just making sure I'm trying to make the best decision for the program with every resource that we have. So I think that's been huge learning for me, that I've, you know, even this year we had a decent year, but just learning, you know, what we want our culture to look like and how that can always be changing and how we can do better there. So I think that's kind of the big learning pieces for me, and things as we reflect at the end of the year is how can we keep improving that going into next year to build, you know, like stronger bonds with the team and even better work ethic and higher standards to keep improving and get better going forward.
Culture is a word you hear a lot around coaches. Give us a couple of examples. What do you do to try to establish the culture you want?
It's different things, whether it's meetings or, you know, just going off playing some pickleball or doing something different, trying to get away from tennis, away from the courts. Just trying to even get the guys to get together themselves and have them kind of build a culture with themselves. When we travel sometimes, you know, we can get Airbnbs where we're spending a lot of time together and doing different things together there while we have more time with each other. I think that's always important to try to, you know, help build that, you know, connection with everyone and get everyone together. So Just a lot of different things and trying to, yeah, do as much as we can off court with each other and spend as much time together as possible.
Colin, do you have some tried and true successful culture builders that you've used during your time?
No, I would agree. I mean, the more you can get the team just interacting together, it's tough because it you know, you can't force it. It does take time, and there's certain years. I mean, obviously, every year, every team is going to be different. So there's some years that it just seems to click better than other years. But yeah, getting the, especially in the fall when we're not on the road as much and we're training more and not competing as much, to, you know, to have those team get-togethers. You know, whether it's, you know, the 16-1 events where we're out supporting another team, team meals, you know, as Dara said, get out the chicken and pickle. Or it can be, you know, the super tough 6 a.m. workouts and the track workouts. I mean, those will bring you together too. You know, in the spring, it happens, you know, a little more naturally because we are traveling so much and spending that time on the road. But still, you know, as coaches, you gotta make sure that, you know, you're kind of aware of, you know, with smaller teams, they're around each other so much, but still you can have some, you know, we'll call it cliques or whatever that can develop, or just some, you know, sometimes that can lead to more tension when it's a smaller group and you're around each other so much. So, you know, at the end of the day, communicate, right? You know, if you sense tensions or something's going on, just get it out there, talk about it, you know, rip the band-aid off. Sometimes it's hard for people, these players as well as coaches, to have those uncomfortable conversations and talk about stuff that you know, their feelings, but it's super important to get that stuff out there, and then that is ultimately how they grow and grow closer. And then, you know, that culture, as I said, you can't force it. You can create the environment for it to grow, and then it can take off from there.
So Dara, who do you go to like as a coaching mentor? You're a young coach, you have a question, or how did you handle this scenario? Who from your past has really been helpful in that way?
Yeah, I mean, the people I've worked for, like Pablo Montana at Delaware, he's always a great resource, a phone call away. Loja Piric, that I worked with at my previous stop, and then Billy Pate, who's been in the industry for many years, and then of course Colin, who's right across from my office. So they're always either a couple of steps away or one phone call away, and always answer and happy to chat and give advice, and definitely helpful in my first couple of years.
What's the best advice you've gotten from Colin?
There's always so much. I think even yesterday I was talking to Colin about certain things. It's just he's always got a level head and always has a good perspective on things, and I think and kind of just gives examples of what he's been through, and I think that always helps. He kind of help you make a decision and help you grow and figure out what the right answer is. But can't remember off the top of my head exactly, but there's a lot I can learn from Colin daily, so it's great to be around someone with that experience that has a good head on their shoulders.
Best win of the season, Dara, which one stands out?
Trying to think. Maybe probably that Denver one, just because I feel that turned the belief around a little bit more after three or four 4-3 losses in a row. Denver last year were unbeaten all season. They were 20-30 in the country last year, and they started off a little rough this year too, and then after they played us, they actually went on and did some good things. But they're a talented team, so I think that was a good one for us to get the win. And then we had some conference wins too, like Charlotte was another good home win that I can think of off the top of my head. But yeah, I think the Denver one stands out. It just helped kind of go into other matches with more belief and confidence that, you know, we're the stronger team and we believe we can win on that day.
Colin, you mentioned Kentucky earlier. Is that the one that would stand out to you?
I'll cheat a little bit. I'll give you a few. So, I mean, Kentucky was definitely the funnest. So I'm going to go a little different direction. I mean, because you were talking about culture earlier. So we went down to Abilene Christian, and a team that we should beat comfortably. But it was honestly, it's a place that we've lost to the last two times we've been there, with 3 and 4 years ago. A little bit of a tough place to play. Scrappy team. And we were having some dealing with some stuff within the team. And honestly, we didn't. Normally, you get to the courts and you practice for about an hour, even if not a little more, before the match starts. And we ended up talking and meeting, and there was some stuff that needed to come out. And we didn't hit a ball until about 25 minutes before the match. We were sitting there on the court having a team meeting. Things were being said that needed to be said, and I was really curious on how that match would unfold. You know, with that, you know, people just having kind of like shared some deep stuff. And, you know, so we came out and we beat them 7-0, as we should have, because we were, you know, a couple levels better than that team. and then took that win and went on a bit of a run. You know, we beat Tulsa comfortably after that. You know, a team that, as I've said, is an at-large team, which was probably our best performance of the year, was that Tulsa win on the road. Really a match that was like never in doubt against a good team, and we beat them 4-1 comfortably. And then went on a great spring break trip, beating La Tech, Tulane, Princeton, and South Florida. So we kind of went on a good run that I feel like started with an uncomfortable conversation that brought us closer together right before, again, an Abilene Christian match. That had we not had that conversation, we still would have won that match. I've got no doubt about that. But I think it was kind of a springboard for some later success that we had.
What was it about that conversation that made it work? Was it led by players? That's what I hear a lot from coaches, is that can be really important. Maybe that wasn't the case in this case, but why did it work out that way?
I think it helped everyone to realize that, you know, when things are going poorly, it's not the end of the world. You're going to, you know, things are going to be said. We got to listen to each other. We also have to be more mindful of the things that we're saying and the, you know, body language and all these things. And I think, you know, the players really learned from it and grew. And it was, you know, even again during that match, like it was just stuff that like would pay off, I think, later in the season for us. And you know, I think we'll continue to pay off for the team down the road. And recognizing that, you know, hey, we can have disagreements, things can come up, but it's not, you know, it's not always personal. It doesn't need to be. And it's, you know, hey, we can still be there for each other, and we are there for each other. And I think they felt that at numerous times throughout the year when, you know, when facing adversity that, hey, like they're still, you know, my coaches and my teammates, that's my rock. That's who I have. And that's who's there for me. And I think, you know, it kind of solidified that in some ways.
You mentioned the crowd at the Kentucky match, and that's one of the things I always think is fun about Shocker tennis is the connection with the tennis community. And maybe that's because, I guess tennis and golf are the only ones that play off campus, so you are in that way more integrated with the, you know, with the community than maybe some of the other teams. But you're always doing clinics and meeting with fans, pizza. You have it's the satellite professionals tour that comes through each summer, so there's a lot of overlap, a lot of connections. Darryl, why is that important?
It's really important, I think, now more than ever with college athletics and just the way things are going. I think it's more important than ever to, you know, be involved in the community and to, you know, try to get as much relationships built for both coaches and for the players and how they can help, that can help them in the future too, you know. So we try to do as much as we can. We obviously, time is restricted and we'd love to do more if we could, but it's very important to try to get more fans out. And people love tennis here in Wichita, so as you said, with the pro tournament, I mean, that's run by our community. It's not run by us, really. It's just the community, and they just love tennis here. So I think the more we do with them, the more they get involved, and, you know, they already support so much. So it's really, really special community that we have here.
Colin, what's that connection with the tennis community? What's that mean to you and your program?
Yeah, it's really neat because you get, you know, Wichita State has such a great fan base for Wichita State athletics, but it's, you know, people that maybe don't have much or any connection to Wichita State, but they're tennis fans, they're tennis players, and they get to know us and they get to know our players, so then they really do buy into the team as well. So we're able to kind of connect with a whole another segment of people in the community that, you know, are KU, K-State, whatever, alum and fans, and get behind our team because we're able to do these clinics, because we're, you know, just at their clubs, whether it's, you know, my team at Wichita Country Club or Dara's team at Genesis, or if we go to Crestview or Riverside and do a clinic or a one-off event where now, you know, they've met a couple players from our team and you know, putting names with faces, and, you know, they come out to a match and have a lot of fun, and then now all of a sudden they're Wichita State tennis fans, and maybe they're, you know, coming out to other sports too. But yeah, it is. It's a great tennis community. And I think being out, you know, again, practicing on a daily basis when we're indoors at those sites helps us to you know, make those connections, you know, day after day, week after week, year after year, and build those strong bonds with the tennis community.
Darryl, who's your favorite professional tennis player to watch?
Currently, I'd say Carlos Alcaraz, but Federer for me was always the one that I loved watching the most and supported the most. So when he retired, it was definitely it's nice to see Alcaraz come along and just the way he plays and the excitement he brings to the game. That's been fun to watch recently.
Is there a professional that you will tell your players quite often, here's a person you should watch and emulate and pick up tips from?
Yeah, I mean, before you definitely say Nadal, just his intensity, work ethic, is how every single point he was always on. He was always one I would talk about. I think Alcaraz is very similar, so he'd be one. Just look at the intensity he brings for every point. I think that's something, especially the way college tennis is played, I think it's important to bring it every point. So those are definitely ones to look for and ones to keep an eye on and try to emulate when you're out there.
Colin, who's the professional players you enjoy watching and learning from?
So on the women's, I mean, Iga Swiatek is, you know, so fun to watch and has so much of a variety. You know, I think as college tennis coaches, we're always rooting for the college tennis players that are out there on the pro tour, which on the men's side, there have been a handful for years, and now there's even more. And on the women's side, they're getting to be more and more. You got Peyton Stearns and Lulu Sun, who played for Texas. Danielle Collins was at Virginia. You know, they're all three entrenched, I think, in the top 50. On the men's side, there's a bunch. So we all, you know, you always root for the players that played college tennis. Growing up for me, it was Leighton Hewitt, you know, kind of a scrappy grinder, fighter, and that's kind of who I emulated my game after.
Who do you send your women to check out, maybe on YouTube or show them clips? Anybody that you think they can get some tips from?
Honestly, like a lot of it's, so much of it is like the mental side of stuff. So there's a podcast out there that I'll recommend, Beyond the Baseline, Jonathan Stokey, mm-hmm. is that what it's called? Yeah. And he does great interviews with everyone. We shared one with Rajiv Ram, college tennis player from my era, who's still out there playing doubles on the pro tour, played for Illinois. And, you know, yeah, there's some like X's and O's type stuff, but just reminding the players, because you hear these pros, there's another good podcast he did with Jess Pegula, who's top 10 player from, she's from the New York area. And so much of it still comes down to the mental game and how much they talk about, you know, how they react and body language and responding to adversity and how to get through, you know, when they're not feeling their best and winning when they're just, you know, struggling and, you know, how they, you know, just all the stuff that we're, you know, hammering on a daily basis in practice and in matches and just reminding them that, hey, you're not alone in these, you know, you're not the only one going through these struggles, these doubts, these ups and downs of confidence and belief and motivation and whatever it is, like every player at every level. So I think it's super important for them to hear that, you know, not just from pro tennis players, but from professional athletes. But there's so much good content out there. But I think, you know, zoning in more on kind of the mental side is what we've, you know, focused on a lot this year, at least.
You've recommended a podcast now. I was going to ask you to recommend a book or a movie, a TV show, something on Netflix you're watching. We'll wrap it up. Do you have something that the people should check out?
I mean, for tennis players, I would say Winning Ugly is a good one.
And it's a book.
It's a book, yeah, by Brad Gilbert. It's always a good one. Yeah, I don't know. Any other ones? There's so many good ones. For, like, I'm talking about the mental side, there's a lot of good ones to read, but that would be a good one, I think, just when you're not playing at your best and being able to figure out a way to get the job done.
Yeah, I mean, Andy Roddick, he's got a good podcast out now, too, that has a lot of good interviews. So, I mean, there's so much, like, podcasts are kind of where things are at now. You know, so, you know, the Jonathan Stokey, Beyond the Baseline, and Andy Roddick, what's his one called? Anyway, search Andy Roddick.
And, serving something.
Yeah, so that's a good one. He's got a lot of good interviews. So those are the two that I would recommend for people.
Okay, great. Excellent. Derek Glavin, Colin Foster, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Great insight as always. Thanks for listening to the Roundhouse Podcast, courtesy of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. We encourage you to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can always find more Roundhouse content at GoShockers.com.
Down to a 3-2 pitch with two men on, two outs in the ninth. The stretch by Tyler Green. Here it comes. Struck him out! A no-hitter for Tyler Green! A strike three call on the outside corner, and Tyler Green has pitched the fourth no-hitter in Wichita State history, the second in as many years, as he joins fellow classmate Charlie Gendron as the author of a Wichita State no-hitter, and in the process struck out a career-high 13, including all three outs in the ninth inning. Tyler Green completes a no-hitter, and Wichita State defeats New Mexico 12-0.